So the first topic was mitzvos tzvichos kavana, which is a mitzvos need concentration. In other words, if the mitzvos are going to do their job, if they're going to help us become closer to Hashem, if they're going to help us become better people, so they need us to concentrate on why we're doing them. And we talked about a number of different types of concentration that are required, but the most basic type of concentration is understanding that I'm doing this mitzvah because Hashem told me to. I'm doing this mitzvah because Hashem wants me to. And when we say mitzvos tzrichos kavana, it means that if I didn't concentrate, if I listened to the shofar without thinking, I'm listening to the shofar because Hashem told me to. If I ate matzah without thinking, I'm eating the matzah because Hashem told me to. If I say Shema without thinking, I'm saying Shema because Hashem told me to. So then I did not get the mitzvah and I have to do it again. So in other words, if I was daydreaming during shofar blowing and I wasn't thinking I'm doing this because Hashem told me to, I would have to go to another shul and listen to the shofar being blown again. If I ate the matzah and I was daydreaming and I wasn't thinking I'm eating the matzah because Hashem told me to, then I would need to get another kezias of matzah and eat the matzah a second time in order to get the mitzvah properly with kavana. And by the same token, if I said Shema, and I didn't think before I said Shema, I'm saying this prayer because Hashem told me to, because it's a mitzvah in the Torah, then one would have to say Shema again. And that's how mitzvos tzvichos kavana applies to Kriya Shema. In other words, if you said Shema with kavana, then you got your mitzvah. If you said Shema without kavana, then you didn't get your mitzvah, and you would have to repeat Shema again. According to the Mishnah Brura, when do mitzvos need kavana? So the Mishnah Brura basically says that mitzvos always need kavana. There were many opinions in Achronim who said maybe action mitzvos don't, and other Achronim said maybe mitzvos that are pleasant, that you eat something that tastes good, don't need kavana. Mishnah Brura says that mitzvos always need kavana. Some people said mitzvos derabanan maybe don't need kavana. The Mishnah Brura says no, even mitzvos derabanan need kavana. The only exceptions that the Mishnah Brura is willing to make is, he says, if you're doing the mitzvah in a mitzvah context, if you're saying Shema and you're wearing your talis and your tefillin and you're surrounded by a minyan who's davening and you're in a shul with the Sefer Torah and with Sfarim, he says at that point, it could be that even though you're not consciously thinking, I'm doing this because Hashem told me to, but subconsciously, you definitely have that in mind. It's impossible, right, not to have some level of kavana when you're surrounded, right, by tefillin, talis, minyan, shul, sefer Torah, everything else. So he says if you're doing the mitzvah in a mitzvah context, that works in place of kavana. The same thing at the Pesach Seder, even if you're daydreaming while you eat the matzah, right? But he says, you're surrounded, you have the Seder plate in front of you and the matzah, right? And the wine and everything else. The father's dressed in a kittel. All of these things, he says, they work in place of kavana. And so if you're saying it in a mitzvah context, then you don't, it's as if you have kavana. But a person, let's say, who's saying Shema, right, at home on the couch in their living room, they don't necessarily have that mitzvah context. And there, the Mishnah Brura says, if a person saying the evening Shema davening Ma'ariv, right, at home, and they don't have kavana for Shema, they should go back and repeat Shema again with kavana, because mitzvos need kavana. Without kavana, you didn't get the mitzvah, and so you would still have to say Shema again. Yeah. So we moved on then to talk about minhagim, and as an introduction to minhagim, we talked about piyutim. Piyutim are poems that were recited in the middle of davening. Sometimes they were recited in the middle of the chazan's repetition of Shmon Esrei. Sometimes they're recited in the middle of Birchos Kriyas Shema, or in the middle of other parts of davening. And when he was chazan, Rabbi Chaim Vital's approach to piyutim was he would say whatever it was, the minhag of the shul where he was davening, whatever the minyan's minhag was, he would say those piyutim. In private, he would not say the piyutim. He only said the piyutim that were composed, right, by the poet Rabbi Elazar HaKalir, who was a very, very early poet, because those piyutim, he felt, didn't count as an interruption in the middle of davening. He felt that those piyutim matched with the themes of the prayers that they were said in, and he also felt that those piyutim did not contain any mistakes because of the stature of Rabbi Elazar HaKalir, who was the composer of those piyutim. But all the other piyutim that had been, written, Rabbi Chaim Vital would not say them when he davened in private, but when he davened in public, when he davened as the chazan, he would say whatever piyutim it was the custom of that minyan to say. And that teaches us two things about minhagim. First of all, it teaches us that anything that you're doing in public, anything that you're doing out loud, anything that the people around you are going to notice if you do differently from them, you're supposed to follow the custom of the minyan where you're davening. So for example, we said that let's say that your personal custom is to say Nakdishach v'na'aritzach at the beginning of Kedusha, but if the minyan around you says Nikadesh Eshimcha Ba'olam, since you're saying it out loud, you should say the way that the minyan says it. Right? By the same token, if your personal custom, right, is let's say to not put your head down for Tachnun, or is to beat your chest at the beginning with Ashamnu Bagadnu, but the minyan that you're davening at does not do that, so then the proper thing is that for those things, you should do what the minyan does. If you need to, right, if you don't put your head down, but just maybe put your head down like this, and without saying anything, but to do the same thing as the minyan, so as not to depart and do things differently in a public way from those people around you. The second thing that Rav Chaim Vital's conduct teaches us about minhagim is that you shouldn't be afraid to be the chazan just because the minyan has a different minhag from your own. Right? So even if you daven, let's say, by Nusach Ashkenaz or Nusach Chabad or whatever it might be, and you're davening, right, let's say, at a Sfardi, you know, minyan, and they ask you to be the chazan, you shouldn't say, oh, it's not my minhag. Rav Chaim Vital, it wasn't his minhag to say these piyutim, but when that didn't stop him from being the chazan in a shul that did have that custom. Mm-hmm.
Is our final going to be on everything come September?
Talk about after, because we're recorded. Yeah. What should one do if his family's minhag differs from his shul minhag? So obviously a person should always try to daven in a shul where the minhag is the same as his family's, but if that's not achievable, so then for all of the public things, he should follow the shul's minhag. For all of the private things, he should follow his family's minhag. So for example, the silent Shmoneh Esrei, follow your family's minhag. But Kedusha, which is said out loud, that you should follow the shul's minhag. Right? And the same thing for all the other parts of davening, those things that are done quietly, you should follow your family's minhag. Those things that are done publicly out loud should follow the shul's minhag. So we talked a little bit about the historical origins of the different nuschaos of tefillah, the different versions of davening. We pointed out that the nusach sfard, we told the story about the four captives, right, and how after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, right, many Jews were exiled to Bavel, right, and that's where the Talmud Bavli, which we study, right, was composed. That was where all the greatest rabbis of the generation were. Around 1,000 years after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, there were four great students of the Babylonian, the Bavli rabbis, who were traveling in a boat, and they were waylaid by pirates. And the pirates took them and sold them as slaves to different towns along the coast of North Africa. And all of those towns, they had funds for ransoming captives, and four different towns along North Africa, each one ransomed one of these great rabbis. And this was sort of how the tradition, right, that came from Bavel, which came in turn from Eretz Yisrael, got transferred to North Africa and eventually to Spain, to the places far further west along the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. So we said that one of these four was Rabbeinu Hushiel. His son was Rabbeinu Hananel. Rabbeinu Hananel had a student whose name was Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi. Right, that's whom we know as the Rif. The Rif had a student named Rabbi Yosef Ibn Megash, the Ri Megash. The Ri Megash had a student named Rabbeinu Maimon. Rabbeinu Maimon was the father of the Rambam. The Rambam obviously is, the pillar of all Sfardi, customs and halacha. Right? And so we can trace directly back the Sfardi, halachos, minhagim, etc., going all the way back from the Rambam to Rabbeinu Maimon, to the Ri Megash, to the Rif, to Rabbeinu Hananel, to Rabbeinu Hushiel. Rabbeinu Hushiel got it from the Gaonim in Bavel. The Gaonim got it from the Amoraim, who got it from the Tanoim in Eretz Yisrael, right, all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu. When it comes to the Ashkenazi, Nusach HaTfilah, we mentioned a different story about the Clonimus family in Italy. Right? One of the members of the Clonimus family, they traced themselves back, right, from the times of the first Beis HaMikdash, how Jews had gone to Italy to, I'm not sure whether it was for trade or whether it was because for of other reasons, but this family settled in Italy and had members of the family in Italy back to the time of the first Beis Hamikdash. And the story goes that one time, this was back in the 11th, 12th century, somebody from the Clonimus family was traveling on business and he got lost and he found himself eventually in Bavel, in the yeshivas of the Geonim. And there was a very, very difficult question that came up. And, you know, he was the only one who knew the answer, even though he wasn't actually from, you know, Bavel himself. And they said, wow, it's incredible. They begged him to stay there to marry the daughter, right, of the head of the yeshiva. But he said, I have to go back. My father's old. But again, this clear idea that the tradition of Ashkenazi Jewry, which traces itself back to the Clonimus family in Italy, goes back to the times of the first Beis Hamikdash and had the stamp of approval of the Geonim themselves. They agreed that the Clonimus family had a true tradition, right, that went back, you know, to ancient times, a tradition which perhaps even they themselves had lost.
You just read all of this on the test?
No. The historical origin of the Nusach Ari. So the idea was is that the Arizal, Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, who lived in Tzfat in the 1500s, he said that there were originally 12 different gates in heaven, one gate for the prayers of each Shevet. And each Shevet would pray differently, and the prayers were sort of directed, they were designed to go through the gate of that Shevet. But the Arizal said that in his times, everyone had forgotten what Shevet they belonged to, even though, right, there are people that the Jews nowadays come from all the 12 different tribes, people from the 10 lost tribes, all the religious people had emigrated to the kingdom of Yehuda before the 10 tribes were exiled, so people nowadays can come from any of the 12 tribes, but people forgot what Shevet they were from.
Rabbi, I thought it was only Yehuda and Levi and Ben Yamin.
All the religious people from the 10 tribes had fled the religious persecution in that kingdom and joined the kingdom of Yehuda. That's why there's a famous sefer called Bnei Yisaskar, which was a sefer by somebody who said that he had a dream that he came from Sheva Yisachar. But Yisachar is one of the 10 lost tribes. The answer is that his ancestors were religious. They were persecuting all the religious people in the kingdom of the 10 tribes. So he fled and joined the kingdom of Yehuda, even though he himself was from Sheva Yisachar. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So that has a trigger. For the answer that I have, you never finished it, but I said, but since we don't know what tribes we're from.
So the Arizal said, I am going to create a version of davening that prayers will go through clear no matter what tribe you're from. He called it the Nusach HaKolel,
so
right? The collective Nusach. I don't know if it's a combination or if it's something totally new, but he said anyone who davens with the version of davening that I am writing, no matter what tribe you're from, it will be as effective as if you were praying the prayers that were meant for your tribe. So Rebbe Ovadia Yosef talks about changing one's Nusach HaTfilah, and he says that since... he says anyone can change, this is Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, anyone can change and start davening like the Sfardim. He says because Ashkenazim, we know there were so many persecutions, there were so many exiles that, you know, probably things got confused. It's not the original version of davening, but the Sfardim, he says, they were living in peace and comfort in Spain for hundreds of years. There were far fewer exiles and persecutions, and therefore, he says, the Sfardi version of davening is most likely to be accurate. It's the most accurate of all the versions, so anybody can go to it because then they're going from their own less accurate version of davening to the most accurate version that we have. That's Rabbi Ovadia Yosef. The Misnagdim say, this is Rav Moshe Feinstein's position, they say that anyone who's Hasidish can switch to daven like the Misnagdim, Nusach Ashkenaz, and Rav Moshe Feinstein says the reason for this is because before the Hasidim came along, all Ashkenazi Jews daven Nusach Ashkenaz. We know that historically, nobody daven Nusach Sfard until the mid-1700s. And therefore, Rav Moshe Feinstein says, if you switch from Nusach Sfard to Nusach Ashkenaz, you're basically just going back to what your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-whatever-grandfather did, right, back before the Baal Shem Tov, back before the mid-1700s. That's Rav Moshe Feinstein's position. Obviously, the Hasidic poskim disagree with that. They say that once it's been the family custom for 300 years, you can't simply go back to what the custom was 400 years ago. You've got to do custom means following, right? The most recent significant amount of family practice. And so Hasidim actually say the opposite. They say that anybody can switch and daven, right? The Hasidic type of davening, because they say that's the Nusach HaKolel. That's what works for everyone. So Nusach Ashkenaz might only work for Shevet Ashkenaz. And Nusach Sfard might only work, right, for, the Sfardi, right, for Shevet, Sfardim. But they say that Nusach Sfard, that's the Arizal. It works for anyone. Therefore, they say that anybody can switch and daven the way that Hasidim daven. However, the Mishnah Berurah says that a person can never change his Nusach HaTfilah. This is one of the ways that we connect. We're stronger when we're connected, to our family, to our ancestors, when we're connected to our community. And one of the ways that we connect to our family and our community is by following the same minhagim that our community follows, by following the same minhagim that the other members of our family, siblings, cousins, parents, uncles, etc., and ancestors, parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents, and so on, when we follow the same customs that they followed, we're connecting ourselves to them, and we're stronger when we're connected. So the Mishnah Berurah says that a person, even though perhaps it might be permissible to switch from one version of, of Shmon Esrei to another, from one Nusach of Tefillah to another, he says it should not be done. Everyone should stay with the minhag of their family. Everyone should stay with the minhag of their community. Stay connected where you're connected, because we're stronger when we're connected to our past. We're stronger when we're connected to our history. And we're stronger when we're connected to other people in our community. The only exception, says the Mishnah Berurah, is if a minhag goes against the Gemara, or against an inference from the Gemara, which everybody agrees is a valid inference. At that point, the minhag will be considered illegitimate, and the Mishnah Berurah points, for example, to certain minhagim that were initiated by the Reform movement. He says those go against the Gemara, and therefore they're considered illegitimate, and even if they were being done, right, for 100 years now, 200 years since that movement was started, but since they're against the Gemara, that's impossible. The Gemara was binding legislation, and you would need to have a formal repeal, right, of that legislation in order for it to be null and void. There never was a formal repeal, and therefore any minhag that was made in violation of the Gemara is unconstitutional and therefore invalid. The third topic we covered was davening in English. I think that the Shulchan Aruch, or the Mishnah Berurah, said that there is seven prayers, not only seven, there's more than that are allowed to be said in English. The list was
Ashrei, Hallel, Shemona Esrei, Birkat Mazon.
Let's find the list. Here it is. Shema, Shmona Esrei, Birkas Hamazon, Kiddush, right? Brachas on mitzvos, brachas on food, and Hallel.
Wait, Shema, Shmona Esrei, Birkas Hamazon, Hallel, what else?
Kiddush on Shabbos, brachas on mitzvos, and brachas on food. We said there's three cases when the prayers cannot be said in English, right? One of them is a person who doesn't understand English himself. You can only say a prayer in a language that you yourself understand. The second case is if...
Oh, we don't understand Hebrew.
Except for Hebrew, because... Okay. Except for Hebrew. The second exception is if you're praying in a place where no one understands that language. So, for example, if you were to travel to France, right, or to Russia, where very few people speak English, so then also you wouldn't be allowed to daven in English. It's only if you understand English and most of the people in your place understand English. And so that's two cases. If you don't understand it, if most of the people in your place don't understand it, and the last case where it may not be said in English is if it's done on a permanent basis. The Mishnah Berurah says that if a person, let's say, plans to never, ever learn to daven in Hebrew, then it will be problematic for them to daven in English from day one. But if they say, I'm working to learn how to daven in Hebrew, right, but it's going to take me time, and while I'm working on that, I'm going to daven in English, but every day I'll learn another line in Hebrew, I'll learn to daven another word in Hebrew, as long as there's progress that's being made, as long as the plan is to eventually, right, start davening in Hebrew, that would be allowed. But he says to just, like, make a shul, right, where it's just, like, taken for granted, the chazan from for now until forever is going to daven in English, that would be a serious problem. There's no permission to daven in English when it's being done on a permanent basis.
Then, like, a word a day, it doesn't have to be, like, a lot of progress?
It doesn't have to be a lot of progress. It's the same thing when it comes to any type of learning. You got to learn at your own pace. If you try to learn too fast, then you're not going to gain anything. You learn at the right pace, right, then you'll be constantly growing. So a person has to know, has to consult with people, you know, who know their personal situation, right? I know that there have been people who I've told, I said, during the school year, you're way too busy, you're studying for tests in lots of different classes, right? You know, you have Gemara and Halacha, right, and Tanakh and Hebrew, and, you know, math and science and English and history, right, and all sorts of other things. You don't have time necessarily to work, you know, practice on your own time on being more fluent in davening. So every summer, I said, every summer, spend 10 minutes a night practicing saying davening in Hebrew and pronouncing the words properly. And that works also. Even though during the year you're not making any progress, as long as you're committed, you've got a plan that eventually you'll bring your davening, you'll be fluent in davening, that works. Two translations of the word vishinantam. Number one, it means you should teach. And number two, it means you should teach it so well that the person shouldn't have to say before they answer a question about what you've taught them. That's a little bit lengthy. In Hebrew, we could say it a little bit shorter. Sheyehei divrei Torah mechudadim, right? Beficha, they should be sharp in your mouth. But that's basically there's a basic translation, which is teach it. And then there's a more expanded translation, teach it so well, right, that the answer should be at the tip of your tongue. And the Mishnah Berurah says that we're discouraged from praying in English because you can't really capture both meanings of vishinantam in an English word. The Hebrew word contains both of those connotations, but in English, it doesn't really, there's no single word that contains, right, both of those meanings. And so that's one of the reasons that we're discouraged from praying in English, because you can't get the full depth, right, of meaning of the Hebrew words when you translate them into English. In addition, the Mishnah Berurah says, there are certain words that we don't really know how to translate. One of them is S. What are the other two words that we don't know how to translate? He says, Totafos is another one. I'm not sure what the third one is. But S and Totafos definitely are two words that he says we have difficulty translating. Maybe Vishinantam was the third one. And then again, just because it's very, very difficult to capture the full depth of the Hebrew prayers in English, that's why he says it's always better to daven in Hebrew, even if you don't understand it, rather than davening in English, even if you do understand it. If you already read Shema and you hear the minyan saying it, what should you do? You should repeat the first six words, the first pasuk of Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. And the reason is because if you don't, it looks like you are rejecting the value that they're affirming. They're accepting all Malchus Shemayim, they're committing themselves to work for the furtherance of Hashem's agenda. And if you don't say it, it looks like you are saying, I don't commit myself to further Hashem's agenda. I'm going to do my own thing. And so in order to show that you're on board with the minyan, in accepting to work for Hashem, so you're supposed to say Shema together with them. If you already said Ashrei or Aleinu, and you hear the minyan saying it, you should also say those things together with them. The Mishnah Berurah says that's Derech Eretz. That's just being basic civility to people, that if they're doing something good, you should join them rather than hold yourself aloof and apart. He says it's basic Derech Eretz. When everyone around you is doing something, right, join them rather than separate yourself from them. Then we talked about the most important parts of the different sections of davening. So we said the most important part of Psukei Dezimra is a pasuk Poseach Es Yadecha U'Maspia L'Chol Chai Ratzon, that Hashem opens up His hands and He satisfies every living thing with its desire. He supervises His creations. He provides for their needs. That's the most important pasuk of Psukei Dezimra, and there's three practical nafkaminas from this idea that it's the most important pasuk. Number one, even if you're not going to concentrate for the rest of Psukei Dezimra, at least concentrate for Poseach Es Yedecha. Number two, if you said Poseach Es Yedecha without concentrating, you should go back to Poseach Es Yedecha, repeat it, and go from there until the end of Ashrei. Number three, if you're short on time and you have to skip, right, all of Ashrei, you only have time for a single pasuk, the pasuk that you say, not the first pasuk, it's Poseach Es Yedecha, because that is the main part of Psukei Dezimra that happens very often by mincha time, right, that if the chazan says Ashrei too fast for you, you don't have a chance to say everything.
What are the last two? You went way too fast.
But at least say Poseach Es Yedecha. It'll be in the recording. The most important part of Shema is the first pasuk, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. And the two practical nafkaminas are, number one, even if you can't concentrate for the entire Shema, but at least if you should try to concentrate for those first six words. Number two, if you said those six words without concentrating on what the meaning of the words are, you should go back and say Shema again, because those six words require concentration, not just that I'm concentrating, that I'm doing a mitzvah like we started off with, but they need a second type of concentration, which is concentration on what the words mean. Hear, O Israel, right? Hashem, who is eternal, who is the master of the world, is my God. He's not just the God of the universe, but he's my personal God. I'm devoted, right, to advancing, right, his values in this world, right? Hashem, again, that means the master of the world and the eternal one. Echad is one, right? There's no other gods. Hashem is indivisible. Hashem is omnipresent. Concentrating on that during Shema, if you didn't, you're supposed to go back and say Shema again. And finally, what's the most important part of Shemone Esrei? The first bracha. And practically what that means is, if you can't concentrate on what the words mean for the entire Shemone Esrei, you're at least supposed to concentrate on what the words mean for the first bracha. So if you don't have time, for example, right, to learn the meaning of the words of all of Shemone Esrei, at least learn what the words of the first bracha mean. If you don't have time to think about the meaning of the first, you know, of all the words of Shemone Esrei, at least daven the first bracha slowly so that you can concentrate on what each of the words in that bracha mean.